The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
We're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, which you can find on Twitter at Zone Coverage. MN, I am your host at Brandon_Warren on Twitter. My name is Brandon Warren, of course, as you might have deduced from my Twitter handle. That incredible laugh that you hear from the other side of the room is Tom Schreier at TSchreier3. He is the producer. He is the co-founder of Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage. And Tom, how are you doing on this rainy Tuesday?
Doing well. Can't complain.
And we do have Tom and I. Tom's going to be heavily involved in this show because he's been covering the Twins on days that I can't. And the guy we're going to lean on the most is on the phone today, across the cities here in the rainy Twin Cities today, is Mike Berardino of the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Mike, how are we doing?
I'm doing well. I'm looking forward to hearing more Tom. This is going to be good because normally he just hangs back, and I'm not even sure if we're entertaining him.
I let the experts do their thing.
Well, that's debatable. Mike, you were covering some event with Rod Carew, whether it was a presser or a phone conference, but talking about how he's the care he's had and all that. In a brief summary, you know, what was going on there today?
Well, it's on Facebook Live. It's still going on as we shift to this podcast. It's you know, obviously that amazing story of the heart donation, and it just came out recently. It's been all over the media. It's been on CBS Evening News that the former Stanford and NFL tight end Conrad Ruland was the one whose death led to a heart transplant, and his organs, Conrad Ruland's organs, have gone to a number of needy patients, but the Carew connection is amazing because he had met him as a young kid, mm-hmm. and he goes, that's the first time there's been a transplant among professional athletes, and Ruland was 29 years old, and of course Carew wore 29 and has the Heart of 29 Foundation, and it's just an amazing story, and they're out at Encino, California right now at a Little League ballpark, and they're still answering questions from the National and Southern California media. It sounded like Rod wants to go around the country now when he gets his strength fully up and speak to schools to get kids encouraged to go home and get their parents to be more heart conscious about their health, because this Conrad Ruland was in tip top shape and he's gone.
How does Rod look right now? I mean, does he look like he's progressing health wise?
I'm just looking at Facebook Live, Brandon. I'm not there, but I mean, he looks. He's talking at length. His answers are normal. One thing I've noticed, though, I don't know if this has anything to do with a heart transplant, but his voice seems deeper. He always had a pretty strong voice, but I mean, he's dropped another octave. And the Ruland, Conrad's brother, Austin, he has an extremely deep voice. I don't know if your heart has anything to do with your vocal register, but as the brother Austin said, he's got a Ferrari heart now. So Rod Carew at 71 has a 29-year-old man's heart inside of him, and it's an amazing miracle of medicine, science, and they're hoping that the whole point of this now is to get more people to sign up as registered donors.
I kind of wonder what goes into publicizing who the donor was, because I feel like that wouldn't be something you'd normally know. I mean, maybe you would, but it wouldn't be publicly known.
Well,
you know, what have you seen
there were some great stories about Alonzo Mourning, because he had a kidney transplant, the great basketball player with the Miami Heat, and he actually was able to meet his donor, who was, I believe, a young person, maybe a teen or 18 or so, and had that person out to Miami Heat games and developed a friendship that's continued over the last decade and a half. But that's different than someone who's passed. And so to meet the family is you know, we've seen a number of these stories about kidneys transplant, you know, within siblings, among siblings, or father to son, or something. But you know, to keep someone's memory alive who has passed, especially at such a young age, is it's just a story that gives you goosebumps and every time you think about it.
Well, not to diminish the importance of it, but you know, this is Twins podcast, at least baseball centric, so we are going to divert our attention over towards the 7-6 Twins, and I do say 7-6 with an uptick, because I don't know, even if you were to take the temperature of this team on social media, I think fans are there are some that are down on Mahler's lineups, how he's used the bullpen, how Gibson is pitching, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think when you step back and survey the forest, you do see a team that's over 500 that is kind of playing at what you might expect their talent level to be, assuming things go right. You know, what is your breakdown for a 7-6 start as far as what this team is capable of?
Well, you know, there's been a couple of early statistical oddities, you know, starting with the fact that they went into last night with what, through 2 weeks, the lowest ERA for any pitching staff, but the second lowest strikeout rate, so that doesn't really smack of sustainability. But you know, the bullpen that people had a lot of questions about, you know, if you break them down individually, it doesn't seem as suspect, because we know what the stuff is like. You've mm-hmm. seen Taylor Rogers now multiple times, again last night, come in and do the job. You're seeing Tyler Duffy, who we've talked about on your show, being a very interesting bullpen possibility over time, since he did it at Rice, and he was excitable, and he lacked a changeup, and here he is with nearly a complete game of relief work so far that's scoreless. So Ryan Pressly's had his problems. That was a tough weekend series against the White Sox, and he's going to have to back people off the plate, it appears, because if you leave a 97, 98 out over, or even an 89-mile-an-hour slider up, it can be taken out. Kinsler's done his job on either side of the cracked nail, and Craig Breslow, I think, has fixed you know, some of the early control. Actually, throughout the spring, as he experiments and continues to hone his new angle, you know, he was not throwing enough strikes, or at least three ball pitch wasn't being spotted, so he was walking a guy an inning. But he looks better last couple times out, so. That helps late leads not get away in general, and I think Pressly over the long term will be very good.
How was his demeanor after Sunday's game, since, you know, that's two games in a very close space of time for him to give up go-ahead and essentially game-winning home runs?
It was good. It was what you need to do when you're a reliever and you give it up. It's you know, accountability is not just a Terry Ryan word. It's a baseball, it's a professional, in any realm, word. You if you mess up, you have to take your medicine. And in baseball terms, a reliever who gives up a key home run needs to be waiting for the media, talk for those for that 1 or 2 minutes. Can't have thin skin about it, because you know, it's on you. You got to wear it. So He did just fine Sunday. Now Friday night he had given it up in an earlier spot in the seventh inning, mm-hmm. and he declined comment. I don't really honestly think he'd been in too many situations where he had given up a home run that was the deciding pitch. He's talked in the past mm-hmm. after a rough outing. He's I think a really accountable guy and good teammate and all those things, and has a big future still ahead of him, even though he's in his fifth year. He's building to more and more, and if he does get entrusted with save situations down the road, he's going to have to be there. And a lot of times fans who are protective of their favorite players or the players themselves, they don't understand why we and the media would only need somebody when they have messed up. Well, it's because if you're going to be 45 or 48 and save chances or something, those 45 times, that's automatic almost. That's not a story. That's dog bites man. It's the failures where in the media we need to get explanations because that's jarring. That's something out of the norm. That's what requires further examination. So it's not being mean to your favorite reliever. If we go ask questions, we're just the conduit between the fan and the player. And somebody needs to know why that happened, and so that's why we ask.
Now, you invoked the name of Terry Ryan. He's been around Target Field a little bit. Have you spoken to him at all this season?
I saw him a couple times in the spring. I've not talked to him at Target Field yet this year. Talked to him at Twins Fest at Target Field, but he said he's going to be around quite a bit.
It's a little strange to see him with a Phillies backpack, I have to add.
Yeah, it's not. I saw Howie Freiling from the Phillies, another Carolina guy, as I am. He was he had the walk off hit, the very first game story I ever wrote at the Daily Tar Heel. So that's always kind of neat to remind him of that. But he's here for the Phillies this series, it looks like. But yeah, we're going to see a good bit of Terry, and it'll be interesting to see with the Andy McPhail ties and the Terry ties, if the Twins and Phillies get together on any deals. I don't know that they made a deal since the Trevor May, Ben Revere, Vance Worley deal. I'm forgetting something. So
I don't think so either.
Odds are, since they share a complex now in the Dominican and information flow should be stronger than ever, they might work something out. Terry might very easily go to Matt Klentak, his GM, and have certain people in the Twin system that obviously he'd be more prone to believing in than perhaps Falvey and Levine would.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is the paths of players who have left. Cleet Thomas and I think Darren Mastriani at one point both turned up in their minor league systems, but nothing in the way of trades. So anyway, moving on, you were in the building when Kyle Gibson pitched last night. I missed a lot of the game because I was working on some baby stuff with my wife. So in a short synopsis, obviously Gibson looked better statistically. And I think the biggest thing that dogged him in the first two starts was bad innings, because he did mix some strikeouts, he mixed some grounders. You know, his command can be kind of scattershot at times. But was last night a step forward, a sidestep, or did he move backwards even though the numbers still looked better?
Well, you'd have to say it was a step forward just because he went deeper into a game than he had in the previous two starts, and that's not saying much because 5 1/3 is something that no starter is going to be patting himself on the back about. He also was beating himself up pretty heartily after the game for giving up that home run to Michael Brantley in the fifth. Now, that came on a four-seamer, and Gibson sounded like he did point out that he gave up some damage on his off-speed pitches previously. So it sounded like he really wants to get back to honing that sinker, maybe some lost trust in that sinker. And as he talked during the spring, there were times when the sinker was not behaving with his new mechanics, his Florida Baseball Ranch mechanics. And for a guy who relied on that so heavily, especially in times of strength, when he could you could know it was coming and you'd still hit it into the ground, that's a little jarring. So it's something to watch going forward. He's already allowed 4 home runs in 14 1/3 innings, and the Romine homer in Detroit was on a slider, and he was really upset with himself over that one. I think he's got a lot of things floating around his head right now. He thought the Tigers definitely were way too prepared for sliders. Tyler Collins took a swing that put a ball in play on a line that was on a slider, and I asked him if he thought he was tipping when we were in Detroit, and he does not think that, but he thinks his sequencing had become too predictable. And I recall in Detroit, the last start, 7 of his first 9 outs came on off-speed pitches. And again, the sinker is really, he needs to have enough movement on that sinker and predictable and corralled movement that you could know it's coming and you still hit it in the ground. And I don't think he's there right now.
How pivotal is Jason Castro going to be in all that? I feel like it's going to be a big deal for him to get on the same page with Castro, because some of those things as far as sequencing, you know, is on the pitcher to execute the pitch and to shake off if he doesn't want to go with that pitch. But the two of them kind of have to work together to get on the same page.
No doubt. And I think back to a conversation I had this spring with Pat Neshek up in Clearwater, another Philly. And his prediction, having worked with Castro down in Houston, was that he offered this up on his own. He said the guy who's really going to benefit from Jason Castro's pitch framing is Kyle Gibson. You know, you think of a guy with late movement, smaller margin for error, not throwing in the high 90s, but needs to get that pivotal pitch. And so far, it would appear that that's not happening. I haven't dug into the numbers. I'm sure you will when we get off this call. But I'll be curious. It's very early, mm-hmm. and I think we all are kind of conditioning ourselves to thinking that Castro, as he learns his staff, I'm going to give him 6 weeks before I really worry too much about the pitch framing. Now, there are just not enough opportunities early to say that he's carried his pitch framing north with him. He will eventually, because he's done it now for 3 straight years. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if the data would show that Gibson's not getting the benefit of what Castro typically has brought to his staffs, and that could just be he's getting used to the way it moves. And Gibson, too, has a less predictable sinker now because of his new mechanics. And so you add all that up, for instance, the right hip pitch that he wants to throw, the two-seamer to the left-hander that he wants to run back over the plate, I don't think he trusts that one at all. So what does he throw Michael Brantley? A four-seamer, and he leaves it up, and it goes out.
Yeah, I saw a couple of two-seamers he threw that were supposed to come back that just didn't quite catch the plate. And I suppose early in the game, and I think it was early when I saw them, you know, if he doesn't have a feel for that early, he's got to kind of ditch it before he digs a big hole, you know, walking guys, because a guy that doesn't strike a lot of people out can't put a lot of guys on, even if he is going to induce some ground ball double plays. You know, there is probably a lot of things in flux for him that he's going to have to rein in, and I think you nailed it there. I think it's a very good, very salient point. Rotation mate Irvin Santana, I was at Saturday's game, and 92 game score on Baseball Reference, one of the 15 best game scores in Minnesota Twins history. Just incredible. I think the best pitched game I've ever seen in person. Granted, my eyes have seen less baseball than yours, but where does that one rank as far as games that you've seen?
Well, I got to watch Roy Halladay throw a perfect game from the stands with my family in Florida once, and that was cool.
Oh, sure.
Especially since my son was still trying to be a pitcher and really liked Doc Halladay, and there he was. Just talk about two-seamer that you could tell him it was coming. Mm-hmm. That was the case. So I covered, believe it or not, people won't believe it after the way he threw last series, but Anibal Sanchez threw a no-hitter his rookie year, and I covered that in Florida, and that was very dominant against the Arizona Diamondbacks. And of course, a lot of the Dontrell Willis rookie year was a big show. It is, and of course, I've seen across the way plenty of Roger Clemens nights, and I've seen Randy Johnson live. All those guys. I mean, I've seen a lot of dominant performances. I was there for LeVon Hernandez's Eric Gregg assisted 15 strikeout game
Braves,
in the '97. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was it. That was the strike zone was the width of an Olympic sized pool, and I wouldn't say that we should forget that game. He did have a lot of help, but it was, you talk about dominance. You triple the size of the plate, he'll be dominant. Irvin was, that was a sneaky dominant game because even Chris Jimenez, who's tremendous interview, and you were there afterwards, mm-hmm. he told us in his 9-minute session that we appreciated every second of, he said that he didn't even realize Irvin was throwing a one hitter until there was one out to go. And Irvin had stepped off the back of the mound, and Jimenez looks past him, and he's, geez, really, one hit? I believe that. It felt like that because I had to scramble in the ninth inning to give it proper significance. You know, but before that, it had not hit me between the eyes, like in the fifth inning or something, that he had been that dominant, I have to admit. I don't know what the hell I was doing, but I wasn't aware until late that this is really happening. I guess mentally I kept thinking that he would be lifted around 7 innings because he had such a big lead. And that's another thing. It's pretty tough to throw a low-hit game when you have a big lead like that. They give you a 5-run first. You usually pitch to the scoreboard and you lay in some first-pitch cookies and they, you know, some of them get hit out. Mm-hmm. But Jose Abreu certainly tried to hit one out, just missed.
Yeah.
But it was great. I wouldn't put it up there as like I don't know. I'm sure the game score is one way to look at it, but I would tell you that you'll correct me on this, but I didn't feel necessarily that I was. It was just so easy, but it wasn't like oh my God, you know, you could get Barry Bonds in his prime back out here and he wouldn't be able to hit him.
No, absolutely. I think, and maybe that speaks more to Irvin's demeanor. It might speak more to the offense he was facing. There could be a lot of layers there. I also think, and you can let me know what you think of this, that he gave up the first hit, the only hit, early to Narvaez in like the second inning, I want to say.
Third.
Okay, yeah. It was early, so it was out of the way. You know, nobody was thinking no hitter, no, you know, for a long stretch of time. So I think part of it is just your condition that, you know, if a no-hitter goes into the sixth or seventh, you might give it more credence. But additionally, his start, I mean, the first three games, that's going to be one of the best first three-game stretches in club history, if not the best. And again, he's not striking out tons of guys. He's not blowing it past guys with 97, 98, though I think his velocity is just fine. But just he's been very, very impressive through three starts.
No doubt, and I think if we go back to the middle of last June, when he really got rolling last year, when his mechanics clicked into place, and that did happen while Eric Rasmussen was up filling in for Neil Allen as pitching coach, mm-hmm. and they did do some really good work in the bullpen because Irvin had been spotty for the first two-plus months, plus a DL stint with the back problem. So if you go back to the middle of last June, he's in a very short list of the top ERAs in the game.
Well, his last shutout.
Starting pitchers.
His last shutout was against Sonny Gray. I want to say it was in Oakland, and I think that pretty closely coincides to when he turned around. You know, within a few weeks, one way or the other. So it was kind of amazing.
It was here. It was at home, and I think on July 6th.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, and because they were in Oakland at the start of June. And,
oh yeah, when Miguel Sano got hurt. That's right. He missed all of June.
Yeah, exactly. So Irvin has been sneaky good. Now, one thing that I'll point out again here that is just amazing in the modern economic landscape of baseball and what starting pitchers get and what a Greinke or a Kershaw can command on the open market, what a Sabathia commanded years ago. But I'm not saying he's like them. But Irvin's making $13.5 million a year. He's under control for another 2 years after this one if you want to pick up the $14 million option mm-hmm. for that 19 season. And as I reported last August, I don't normally like to keep bringing these things up, but it is amazing that he cleared waivers in August. Anybody could have had him. He'd been rolling for 2 months, and nobody wanted to just pick him up without giving up a player and just assume the money. So that explains to you why he wasn't traded perhaps this offseason. I don't think they were aggressively shopping him the way they did Dozier because he cleared waivers without player cost in August, and in part because there's still this fear in the back, at least it's a leverage point, that if you have a trade conversation with somebody, they can bring up internally, they can bring it up when they're talking to you, that because he had the 80-game suspension in 14 or 15, that if a second one, let's see, if he gets banged for anything gets in there erroneously into his smoothie,
yeah,
he could miss a whole season.
Sure.
So that does harm his value, especially when you only have him under control now for, he's guaranteed nearly two full years, but he is controlled for three. So I've seen this happen with other guys that have had a suspension for PEDs, and it make it harder to deal them. I don't think anyone would think, considering how long his career was before this one blip, and how much he had achieved in a variety of places. I don't think anybody would say that explains that first decade in baseball. No,
yeah.
And what he's done since then would tell you, well, he really, if he did do anything, he didn't really need it. That's a head-scratcher still, but it does explain a little bit of the reluctance to buy in or to pursue around the game.
In your mind, though, how much do you also weight the tendency of teams to think the Twins would pull him back and prefer to let him clear and work out a non-40-man deal? I mean, is there part of that in your analysis or thought process?
Why wouldn't you? What the hell was the reason to not even put in a claim? There's no problem pulling people back. Nobody put in a claim.
Sure,
cleared.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just thought maybe if he clears, then it's you're not shoehorned into that to the point where they wouldn't put him on again. I don't know. I'm just thinking.
Well, there's really no. Think it through now. There's no benefit whatsoever to not putting in a claim for somebody that you would like to give up a player to acquire.
Sure, because like Alex Rios, they just let you have him.
They let you have him sometimes. Jose Canseco, the Yankees just got him. Congratulations, you got him. These things do happen. And Vernon Wells went to the Angels that way. You got him. And this was not a gotcha. This would not have been a you got him kind of thing. It would have been, ooh, we got him. But they didn't, and no one did. And it's still I'm positive that that was how it went down. And it's it does, I think it still colors the way the Twins will proceed with him going forward.
What's your early read on Justin Haley? I think he's been fairly decent. Obviously, he does have the age to the point where you maybe don't have to be as worried about throwing him into certain situations, but he is still making a fairly big jump. I think he's done a fine job, and if he can, you know, I asked Molitor this, if he can continue to lock down multiple innings at a time, it may allow them to move Tyler Duffy into a higher leverage situation. But then again, too, it'll depend on how they want to use Michael Tonkin, because he's not really an ideal long guy either. But I feel like Justin Haley has done pretty much all they could have asked for a Rule 5 pick.
I agree with that. And he's done exactly what a Rule 5 pick should do from day one of spring training. He's kept his head down. He's kept his ears open. He's done whatever they asked. They gave him a start or two even in the spring. They gave him plenty of opportunities to piggyback and show how he could handle. This is a guy who obviously does not have a big fastball. He has a sneaky fastball. He has that crossfire thing that Molitor was noting right in the very first live BP when I took a picture of Molitor from the, he was standing as though he were in the right side of the batter's box, trying to get an idea what it would be like to face that, and it's not comfortable.
I'm sure not.
And so the ball does have some late life on it, and Haley, I don't think you will see, to answer your point about leverage, they might say that, but I don't think you're going to see him in any leverage situations for quite some time. They were able to nurse J.R. Graham through, for the most part, while contending in 2015. They obviously were able to nurse Ryan Pressly through in 2013 with a bad, bad team. Some of this will be determined by the standings. But the nice thing is I think Justin Haley's already shown them enough on and off the field that, first of all, that was a very good pick when they were trading out of the number one pick, and basically they got him for free, if not somebody paid them for him to take him. You know, they saved their $100,000.
Right.
That's pretty good. You take Justin Haley for free. You know, they got beaten up a little bit for opening the year with the 8-man bullpen, but as Phil Hughes pointed out after his start in Detroit, and Haley finished up, he said that's exactly why you want to have a guy like that around, because look what it does to set up the next few days in the bullpen. And even though Ryan Pressly wasn't able to close the deal or do his part of it over the weekend, the Twins did have virtually everybody at their disposal except Justin Haley. So that's where he's so valuable. Tonkin, in that long role last year, was always an odd fit because he's a guy with a lot of saves in the minor leagues. He's used to pitching the eighth and the ninth, and then you ask him to come in there in a third or the fourth sometimes, and that's just not his thing. This would be more of a Duffy thing, but then now we're seeing Duffy get a chance to work later and later in the game, but warming up quickly is still an issue for Duffy. Mm-hmm. Molitor said they're really being careful with that, and they should.
I think you kind of touched on this, but Molitor seemed to indicate last night he wants to find a role for him. He said something along the lines of, he told him it's been a little bit of a roller coaster. So best case scenario, Haley's the long reliever, right? And I don't think, you know, he's a setup guy, but it seems like Duffy could do what he did last night where he gets two innings in kind of a role like that.
Yeah, right? Like a multi-inning weapon.
Yeah,
Maybe not Andrew Miller, but in the context of it, I think he could be a weapon as a multi-inning guy. Mike, do you agree with that?
Sure. I there's no reason he couldn't. The thing is, better to use him that way than to get him up in the fifth and then sit him down and then get him back up in the seventh quickly and, you know, pop him in for one out and then he's out. He's not going to be that kind of reliever. What he really might be, though, what they're going to have to start thinking about, I don't think we're on DEFCON 2 or anything, but I think that Kyle Gibson you know, especially with Duffy lining up with him yesterday. Kyle Gibson needs to have a vintage Kyle Gibson start in the next two or three outings before they get tempted to just let Duffy start. And the same might go for Mejia, although Mejia showed a better poise and better pitchability last time out in a five-inning wet game.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So on the offensive side of things, what do you make of Joe Mauer's start? Because he's not striking out. He's putting the ball in play. Not walking a ton, but has been hitting the ball right at people. I think his start is a little bit misleading in that he's not hit as poorly as the line looks, but he's also really not hitting all that well either.
I don't know. The last we saw his line drive percentage was 28 or something. You'd take that. Maybe it's a little lower. But
he's hitting the ball in the air, too, which I noticed.
He's always going to have loud outs because, as Mulder said, he's one of the most predictable hitters in the game with the spray charts. I mean, you could almost defense him with your eyes closed and just hold your glove up, and somebody's going to have a ball going to their glove. It feels that way sometimes, especially when Alex Gordon's out there. But strikeouts are down. I like that part because he was there was more swing and miss to his game the last couple of years than anybody could have imagined. So if he's hitting the ball sharply and he's putting the ball in play more often, more Mauer-like, it should normalize pretty quickly. And he's got three hits. And I know he made the last out last night, and everyone's going to seize on that. He did have a stretch of three hits and four at bats or something leading up to that, but I don't know. I think he's probably going to settle in roughly to what the numbers were last year. I don't see a massive drop off, and I don't see a massive surge. But health is always the first thing. If he's on the field, he's got a chance to do the kinds of things his talent would indicate. But and he's going to hit exactly 11 home runs somewhere. They're all going to be opposite field, maybe one to the pull side. And what I have noticed is he's not worried about the pull side this year. We're not hearing that Brunansky did try to make that a point of emphasis a couple years ago just to try to throw off the shifters. But I think they've given up on that. And the Mauer zone, the line drives to left center where the center fielder's playing 15 steps to his over toward left field, that and the left fielder's on the line, that's going to continue.
Whose start do you think is more sustainable, Jorge Polanco or Max Kepler?
Well, Kepler wasn't really having a hot start until just the other day, right?
Yeah,
he was quiet. As Mulder said, not horrible, not great. We have no reason to doubt their ability to have perfectly good seasons. The one thing that's in because of their pitch recognition and their discipline at every level, the thing that's in Polanco's favor is being a switch hitter. He's not going to have that same-sided disparity that Max can have. Max has had some good moments against lefties here of late. That's good. He needs those. But he also is prone to lengthy downturns against lefties, and because they have Robbie Grossman, who can do what he does against lefties as a switch hitter, there's going to be the temptation to sit Max against any really nasty lefty. So that's why I don't see a big fade for either guy. I'm in on both those guys. I think they're going to have nice long careers, and I think they'll be up all year.
Who do you expect to get going more quickly, Eddie Rosario or Byron Buxton? Because two of the three regular outfielders are both struggling quite badly.
Well, Eddie's starting to show some signs in that he had a two-hit night finally, and he actually worked a count to 2-0 before he jumped on something and hit it sharply for an RBI hit up the middle. Mulder had a little talk with him yesterday, told him you were aggressive, but you need to let the game come to you a little bit. I asked Eddie what he took from that. I'm not sure that he shed any additional light on that, but he did seem to get the message because although he went from 3-0 to a strikeout against Salazar late, and Salazar threw him a changeup that moved like a slider. So I still don't know what the heck that was. And Eddie was shaking his head, and Salazar just walked off laughing. It was kind of a funny moment, but I don't think anybody could have. But the problem is Eddie swung at it. You know, it almost hit him, and he swung at it. So he's still chasing way too much. Buxton is trying to zone things up. The problem is it's a little. I don't know what's worse. getting out of the zone and being a and sometimes putting balls in play that are clearly out of the zone and having a 45% chase rate, or being a guy who is staying in the zone more so but missing, swinging and missing at strikes repeatedly to the point where, you know, you probably know the more updated number, but it was ridiculously high, 45% maybe swing and miss rate at pitches in the zone. I don't know. It's just kind of like invisiballs. They're throwing Buxton invisiballs, and nobody hits those.
All right, the last thing I got for you before we let you go, what do you make of this Miguel Sano hot start? Because it's walks, it's power, it's adjustments being made in-game. If he pops up a 2-0 pitch in the first at bat, he's going to attack a fastball the next time around. I would say he gave Cody Allen all he could handle in that at bat in the ninth inning last night. It just very impressive discipline. You know, he's still swinging hard and striking out quite a bit, but I've got to be impressed, and I think everybody's got to be impressed with what he's done through 13 games.
Yes, that's been good. This is very encouraging, and you know, he's even made some nice plays on the defensive side, and he chased down that ball over near the tarp, during Irvin's game that was helpful. He's fully engaged. He's not letting calls get to him. He's even gotten a couple of calls where they actually said that he checked his swing, which, as I noted on Twitter, I couldn't remember the last time that had happened because he got on the wrong side of the umpiring crew last year, a week into the year with John Hirschbeck, with their exchange. And it's one thing to have an exchange. It's another to talk about it publicly afterwards, and I was in the midst of that, but it did follow him. But it'd be nice if he could have just normal treatment from umpires, everybody do their thing. And if that happens, he has every opportunity to put up massive numbers. It would help, too, if the people in front of him are on base more. And so, you know, hitting with somebody on base is going to be good, more important than hitting with somebody behind you. And I don't think, you know, we saw an interesting dynamic last night with Joe behind him. And, you know, I remembered and noted on Twitter that Francona had intentionally walked, I forget who, to maybe Rosario, to get to Mauer last year. And then Joe had the first walk-off hit of his career in more than a decade.
Wow.
And last night was kind of an unintentional. They pitched carefully to Sano, even with that loud foul that nearly tied the game. And Mulder noted he didn't see any fastballs in the hitting area. The fastballs were waste pitches, and the breaking balls were the ones that and Allen has a real good one. So they pitched him carefully, and then Mauer ended the game. But I think Bill James has shown us for quite a while, correct, that it's more important to have people on base in front of you than a bopper behind you. But you'd kind of like to have both.
Yeah, we'll see what the lineup looks like and if there's any tweaks coming here soon. That's Mike Berardino. I'm Brandon Warren. For Tom Schreier, you've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.